Let me be the last person to thank the organizers for this conference. I think it's been really great so far. I think we can probably all agree that. Oops. And okay, I'm going to be talking today about some joint work with Matt Pusey and Rob Speckens here at PI. I'm from IQC, and I work in Kevin Rush's group, and we do quantum optics experiments. Okay. So I'm going to be focusing on the operational signatures topic of this conference. But kind of more generally, I'm just going to be talking about a data analysis tool that I hope will be useful for not just contextuality experiments, but more broadly for experiments in the field of quantum foundations. My motivation for this tool I'm going to talk about is that when we're doing experiments in the field of quantum foundations, many of those experiments are looking for deviations between quantum theory and how nature truly behaves. And I think that the data analysis techniques that we use should not rely on quantum theory at all or assume the correctness of quantum theory. Specifically today, I'm going to be talking about a way to do tomography. Normally in quantum tomography, what we try and do is take a given a set of experimental data, we try to find a set of quantum density operators and measurement effects which describe that data. Obviously, this assumes the correctness of quantum theory. Today, I'm going to be talking about a way to do this tomography in the generalized probabilistic theory framework. So we try to find GPT states and measurement effects which describe the data. And then at the end of the talk, I'll talk about how we can apply this to an experimental test of non-contextuality, and specifically it will be preparation non-contextuality in the spec and sense that we're considering. Okay, so my talk's roughly divided into three parts. I'll start by introducing the GPT framework and the relevant features for the experiment that I did. Then I'll talk about the actual GPT tomography method and how we applied it to experimental data, and then finally the non-contextuality inequality. Okay, so the GPT framework is motivated operationally, and today I'm going to assume that we have some experiment with some preparation device with a number of settings, some measurement device also with a number of settings. And we're interested in describing the measurement statistics of this experiment. And by measurement statistics, I mean the probability of getting a specific outcome, given that you've implemented a specific preparation and done a specific measurement on it. For this talk, I'm only going to consider measurements with two outcomes, namely 0 and 1. I can do this without loss of generality, because you can always post-process measurement outcomes and coarse-grain outcomes together, so you can describe measurement, any k outcome measurement with a series of two outcome measurements. And the reason that this is convenient is that we can fully specify any measurement just with the probability of getting outcome 0. Because the probability of getting outcome 1 will just be 1 minus that. Okay, so one way to find a GPT state, which describes, which we can use to predict any measurement outcomes, is to just, you know, for a given preparation, just perform every possible measurement we can think of on that state and just record a list of the probabilities. I think on Wednesday in the discussion session, Julio said this was very boring. but it will work, but I'll talk about a better way to do this. And then if you want to recover a measurement probability, you can define an operational effect vector, which is a vector of all zeros, except the jth entry will be 1. And then we can recover the probability of getting outcome 0 by just selecting the jth entry of your operational state. And you do that by taking the dot product of these two vectors. Okay, in general, for any theory, there will be some set of k measurements. K may or may not be finite, but there will be some set of k measurements which is less than any measurement you could do, which will fully determine each state. And we'll call this set of measurements a tomographically complete set of measurements. And then we can reduce our operational state to just a k-element vector. And if we want to predict measurement outcome probabilities for some measurement that's not in the tomographically complete set, then the GPT framework will ensure that there's just some function, some unknown function f, which we apply to S, which returns the relevant outcome probability that we're interested in. In the next two slides, I'm going to show that this function f is linear, which is useful. And to do that, we need to start by considering convex linearity of operational states. So imagine three preparation procedures, PA, PB, and PC. And I'm just going to define the preparation procedure PC as some convex mixture of the two procedures A and B. And what I mean by that is we flip some biased coin, and if it lands heads with probability W, we implement procedure PA. If it lands tails with probability 1 minus W, we implement procedure PB, and then output some state to measure. Given that this is a valid preparation, we can recover the outcome probabilities on preparation C by just taking the relevant convex mixture of the probabilities between A and B. And given our definition for this unknown function f, we can just sub that into here, and we see that the we can take the convex mixture of these functions on the operational state as well. Furthermore, we can just consider the measurements inside the tomographically complete set of measurements. And if we consider each one in order, we can apply this formula on an element-wise basis, and we can show that the operational states themselves can be represented by this convex mixture as well. Finally, these two facts together, we can sub this formula into this guy, and what we end up with this. And what this shows is that our function f has to be convex linear. So it's linear if the weights that you use are numbers, real numbers between 0 and 1. OK. It turns out that convex linearity, in general, will imply just general linearity. So what I've done here is just replaced my probability weights W with real numbers alpha. And I'm not going to go through the proof of this. In Hardy's quantum theory for five reasonable axioms paper, he has a nice proof. But the important point from the last two slides is that this function f will always be linear on the operational state S. And what that means is that for any measurement we consider, we can define a measurement effect related to the zeroth outcome of that measurement as just another vector. And then the way that we recover outcome probabilities is we take this measurement effect vector, take its dot product with the operational state, and that's how we recover probabilities in this theory, or in this framework. Okay, and to get to this point, all I've considered so far is, or all I've assumed is just classical probability theory. And kind of maybe the most important assumption from classical probability theory is this convex mixture of preparations. I wouldn't even call that an assumption, actually. It's just something we can take for granted. Okay, so I want to give some examples now of different general probabilistic theories for different systems. So I'll start with the simplest one, which is just a classical bit. It will have some state vector with two elements, some effect vector with two elements. And we can plot the state space of this classical bit. It looks kind of boring. It's just a line. And what I've decided is just to represent one state of the bit with this 1, 1 vector, the other state of the bit with this minus 1, 1 vector. And then this line in between represents any convex mixture I take of the two states of the bit. The effect space, we can calculate the effect space just by remembering this formula of how we get probabilities. And the effect space looks like this. So there's kind of four important, or four extremal effects in the effect space. This effect here is the one that outputs probability 0, or sorry, outcome 0 with probability 1 when it measures this state. This effect outputs outcome 0 with probability 1 when it measures the opposite state. This guy up here is the what I'm going to call the identity or the unit measurement. This is the measurement which just ignores the actual state of the system and upon receiving a state outputs outcome 0 with probability 1. This state down here is the opposite of the identity. It outputs outcome 0 with probability 0, or it outputs outcome 1, and ignoring the state of the system. And okay, that's a valid GPT for a classical bit. Maybe a slightly more complicated example is a GPT for a qubit. So we know from quantum mechanics that a qubit is represented as some linear combination of Pauli operators with the identity, and a measurement effect is represented again as some combination of the identity and the Pauli operators. And the way that we, in quantum mechanics, calculate probabilities is by the Born rule, seen here, and you can decompose this this expression into the dot product of two vectors. And so all I'm going to do is just represent, I'm just going to define this vector to be my operational state and this one to be my operational effect. And if we look at the state space of a qubit, quantum mechanics limits the range of values for these three elements of the operational state. I'm going to ignore the first entry of the state and just plot the last three elements of the operational state, and we get the block sphere out. And for the effect space of a qubit, there are now four parameters in it, so I've plotted two three-dimensional projections of the four-dimensional effect space. The surface of the sphere on the right is the space of projectors, and this point up here represents the identity measurement. This point represents the zero measurement. And okay, this is a qubit space. These GPTs are, or the GPT framework can consider more general theories than just quantum and classical mechanics. So here's another example. This is generalized non-signaling theory. Sometimes this is called box world. The state space looks like a cube instead of a circle. And if you have, this is the state space for one particle. If you have two of these particles and correlate them in the right way, you can recover PR box correlations with this GPT. And kind of a hand-wavy way to explain why that is that, in this theory, there are some states, for example, this one, which respond deterministically for multiple effects, so anything on this plane, for example. And also there's some effects, for example, this one, which respond deterministically to multiple states. So example, maybe this plane. And we can look at other GPTs as well, so I just talked about these two. This is a GPT for Speckan's toy theory. This is an entirely classical theory, and then it has some additional epistemic restrictions. We've seen this already this week. This is just the GPT representation of it. I simulated some random data and figured out what GPT would represent that data. I got something that looked like this. Anyways, this is a very general framework, which can represent lots of different theories. One more fact about GPTs is the idea of you can calculate these things called dual state and effect spaces. And for a given, a GPT specifies a valid set of GPT states and a corresponding valid set of GPT effects. But just given that state and effect spaces, there may be some other logically possible states and effects that aren't included in your GPT. And what I mean by that specifically is a GPT effect is logically possible if when you do a measurement with that effect on any possible state in your state space, you get a probability back, so some number between 0 and 1. A GPT state is logically possible if it returns probabilities for any effect in your effect space. And I'll just call the space of possible, logically possible effects the dual of the state space. And I'll call this space of logically possible states the dual of the effect space. Just some terminology that I'll probably use today, because this is how I colloquially talk about it. I say if the state and the dual of the effect space are equal and the effect and the dual state space are equal, I'll just be calling those self-dual. This is kind of more commonly known. maybe to some of you as GPTs which satisfy the no restriction hypothesis. Okay, so if we go back to the example GPTs that I just talked about, these black wireframes represent the dual spaces. So the a wireframe on a state space represents the dual of the green effect space. A wireframe on the effect space represents the dual of the blue state space. The qubit and the box world theories are self-dual. Speckens toy theory is classical theory with additional epistemic restrictions on it. Therefore, the GPT does not satisfy the no restriction hypothesis, and these theories are not self-dual. And for this random GPT, it happens to not be self-dual either that I simulated. Okay. So those are all the relevant features of the GPT framework. So now I'll talk about the way that we actually do tomography on experimental data and an experiment that we performed. Okay, so if we go back to our experimental setting, we can imagine performing a large number of measurements on a large number of states, and we can acquire some table of data like this. And just to parse this table of data quickly, each column represents a specific measurement, and each row represents the statistics for a specific preparation. For technical reasons, I've reserved the leftmost column to represent the identity measurement. So this, with probability 1, will output outcome 0, regardless of the state. And if the tomographically complete set of measurements has cardinality k, then what that means is that this table of data will have rank k. Just a feature of matrices means that we can decompose it into two rank k matrices. So this is a matrix which is the number of preparations by k, and this matrix, I guess these should be k minus ones actually, that's a typo. And this is the k by the number of measurements. And just by doing this factorization, we've recovered a GPT state representing each preparation, and a GPT effect representing each measurement. Okay, so for example, this would be the GPT state for preparation 2. This would be the GPT effect for measurement, the outcome 0 portion of measurement 4. And if we want to recover probabilities, you just undo the matrix factorization, and you take the dot product of the state vector with the effect vector. And for me, looking at the factorization in this way makes it a little bit more clear why I've been, you can always plot the state space in one fewer dimensions than the effect space. And the reason is that GPT states always, you can always find a factorization such that the GPT states start with a 1 here. So the first element of these GPT states doesn't really contain any information. So we can just think about the k minus 1 elements which represent it. Okay. In real life, if we actually try and take this table of data, we're not going to measure these probabilities exactly. There's noise in our experiment, specifically from only doing a finite number of trials of these measurements. And what that means is we'll only be able to measure noisy versions of these probabilities. That's not a problem, but all it means is what we have to do is we have to find a rank k matrix of best fit, which can explain our table of data. So to summarize kind of the procedure for this GPT tomography framework, you start with some table of raw data, and then as a next step, you need to fit the data to a rank k model. And part of that fit is determining the best value for k. And then once you have that rank k model, you can get this decomposition. And you can just plot the state and effect spaces and see what you get. If you want, you can calculate the duals, see what you get as well. Yes?
Could you remind me what k is?
K is the number of measurements in your tomographically complete set of measurements. So it's equal to the dimension of the data, the dimension of these of the effect space, and it's one more than the dimension of the state space.
So it's less than m and n.
Yeah.
So the endpoint of your preparation spectrum measurements.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so the experiment that we actually did is a cartoon of what it looks like. We measured the, we did preparations and measurements on the polarization state of a single photon. Since I am an experimentalist, I can tell you a little bit about how this works. The way that we prepared single photons was with the heralded single photon source. So we have some blue laser, which enters a nonlinear crystal, and with some probability, individual photons from that blue laser will, it's called downconvert, or they'll split into a pair of two lower energy photons, which happen to be red, and then they go this way through the experiment. We can set this up so these photons have the downconverted photons have opposite polarizations, so we can pick one of them off with this polarizing beam splitter, and if we detect a photon here, then we know that we have another photon in this arm of the experiment. We can prepare the polarization state by varying the angles of some wave plates and birefringent crystals. And then the way we do the measurements is with the polarizing beam splitter and a detector at each output. And we set the basis of the measurement by varying wave plates as well. We post-select on so we say one trial of the experiment is successful if we get a detection here and at one of these detectors at the same time. And that means if that happens with high confidence, we're measuring two photons from the same pair. Okay, this is what it actually looked like in the lab. These are the mounts, which fortunately for me are motorized, and I can just program to spin the wave plates. So this is how we prepared. The measurements, our polarizing beam splitter is here, and then the light from either output of the beam splitter is coupled into one of these two fibers, which goes to a single photon detector. And we had this single mode fiber in between the preparation and measurement stage. And what that did is it removed any possible spatial degrees of freedom that might have been affected by our polarization preparation, and that just ensure that we were only looking at the polarization state of the photon and no other degrees of freedom. So we decided to do 100 different preparations and 100 different measurements on each preparation, and we got this table of data, which looks like this. Bunch of numbers between 0 and 1, so that's good. Noise, as I said before, noise in our experiment ensures that this table of data has full rank, so a rank 100. So the next step is we had to perform some fits, and what we did is we chose various ranks to fit to, and we just did some statistical tests to see which performed best. I should say that since we in quantum mechanics, you represent the polarization state of a photon with a qubit, so we expect to get k is equal to 4. If quantum mechanics is correct. Okay. So the first test we did is we chose a given rank of the matrix K, and we just we varied over all rank K matrices, and we tried to minimize this chi-squared statistic, which kind of quantifies how far your model is from your actual data. And just an example of how this chi-squared works for if you're fitting data to a line. This minimization procedure does is just tries to minimize the squared sum of differences between your data and your model. We also constrained every element in our model to be a real probability, so we can interpret those entries as probabilities. And the way that we actually did this, this minimization, this is in general an NP-hard problem. There's no analytic solution to it. So what we did is we parameterized our rank K matrix as a m by k times a k by n matrix. We started with some initial guess for S, optimized over E, used that new optimization, and that fixed that, and then optimized over S, and just alternated until we found convergence. So, okay, these are the results that we got. So this is a plot of the chi-squared statistics versus the model rank. The black x's represent the minimum chi-squared value we were able to get, and these red triangles represent the value that we would expect to get if our model fit our data well. So what we can determine from this is that models of rank 2 and 3 underfit the data. They do not fit the data well at all, so we can kind of throw those out. But it seems like models of rank 4 or higher seem to perform pretty well. So the next step is to distinguish among these which is the best one. So the second test we used is called the AKAK information criterion. And what it is it's a balance between how well your model fits your data and the number of parameters in your model. So it's defined as negative 2 times the log of the likelihood function. The likelihood function is the likelihood that you got the set of data that you did given a specific model represents your data. And n is the number of parameters in that specific model. In general, as you increase the rank of a matrix, you need more parameters to describe it. A lower value of this AIC criterion implies a higher likelihood that your model is the correct one to represent your data. And as I said, it's kind of a trade-off between not underfitting and not overfitting, and overfitting. Yep. For normally distributed independent errors, it turns out the likelihood function takes a simple form, and we can reduce our AIC expression as just 2 times the chi-squared value plus the number of parameters in the model. So what this AIC test is good for is it's good for comparing different models in a set of candidate models to each other. So if you have some list of candidate models, you can assign each of them an AIC score, and the one with the lowest AIC value will be the most likely model to represent your data. And there's a way to quantify what I mean by most likely, and it uses this expression. The denominator is just a normalization factor, so you can ignore that. And the numerator, it's for a given model, it's AIC value minus the minimum AIC value. And there's an exponential dependence on this difference. So going back to our example of fitting some model to a point, this AIC test could tell you, which of these two models is more likely to represent the data. And that kind of depends on the size of the error bars on the data. OK, so for our actual experiment, these are the AIC values we got for each model rank. Because the chi-squared was so large for ranks 2 and 3, the AIC is still very large. But if we zoom in on the models that we are trying to distinguish, we see that the rank 4 model is the best one. And when we apply our relative likelihood formula, it seems that with very high probability, the rank 4 model represents our data. With some low probability, the rank 5 model is the best. And for all other model ranks, this probability was less than 10 to the minus 13, I think. So essentially 0. So the conclusion we're going to make is that we'll just use k is equal to 4. All right, so I've done this part of the GPT tomography procedure. The next step is to plot the state and effect spaces that we got. And this is what we have. So it looks a lot like quantum mechanics. However, there are some important differences. So we get it's not quite a sphere, it's not a smooth shape, but something that kind of approximates a sphere for the state space. And each vertice on the shape represents one of the preparations that we actually implemented in the lab. So there's 100 vertices on the shape. I didn't count them, but I think it's 100. And this is what the effect space looks like. Again, it has the same type of properties. And now if we calculate the dual spaces and plot them, this is what we get. So just to remind everyone, the wireframe on this shape is the dual of the green effect space. The wireframes here are the dual of the blue state space. And if you zoom in, you can see that there is some small gap between our reconstructed state space, the solid shapes, and the dual spaces, the wireframe shapes.
Between the extremal points and the wireframe? Just between the extremal points?
Because we didn't measure perfect probabilities, there is a gap between the extremal points and the wireframe as well. If we happen to get perfect probabilities for everything, then I think there would not be a gap, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Sir, this gap is between what and what? Because I understand you don't say about gap between your model and quantum mechanics, obviously. So what describes the black lines and the blue?
So the blue solid shape is the convex set of the GPT state descriptions of the preparations that we actually implemented in the lab.
Right.
And the wireframe is the set of logically possible states. And those logically possible states are calculated by looking at the green effect space and finding the space of states which give you probabilities when you measure them with any possible effect in the effect space. Yeah. So what we can learn from this this data is we know that the true state space has to lie somewhere between the space of states that we did in the lab, because we could always imagine doing more states and getting things outside of the sphere. And in fact, quantum mechanics predicts that that's true. But the true state space has to lie somewhere between the solid shape and the true state space has to only include logically possible states, so it has to lie somewhere between the solid shape and the wireframe. Was there a question?
Yeah. So here on the left hand side, you have this black compass hole.
Mm-hmm.
That is the logically possible states, and you do the same thing on the measurements by taking the dual of the blue shape, so to say.
Yes.
Now, do you know if these two areas are self-dual, like the black area here and the black area here?
They are.
No,
they can't be. The two black areas can't be self-dual, and the reason for that is this black area is the dual of this space. So if I was to calculate the dual of this black area, I would just get back to this blue state space, which is not equal to the wireframe of this shape. Yeah. And it's actually the gap goes the wrong way. So if I was to take I know that I could find some state on some extremal point of the wireframe here, dot it with some extremal point on the wireframe here, and get a probability greater than one, or a negative one.
But it does look like there could be a sphere between those two things, which has a corresponding sphere between the other two, which is subdual. So the data seems to be consistent with some true theories which are subdual.
Yeah. Although we haven't explicitly checked that. But it kind of looks like it might work. Okay, so the true state space has to lie somewhere between these two shapes, and the true effect space has to lie somewhere between the dual of the true state space and the green effect space that we measured. We can quantify kind of the size of this gap between the spaces and their duals by looking at the volume ratio. And we find it's about 91%. So this is the ratio of the volume of the blue state space to the wireframe here. If the theories were self-dual, then this ratio would be one. So we could imagine doing just more preparations of measurements to increase this volume ratio. If we could do an infinite number of preparations, then maybe we could find a smooth shape here. But we're always going to have some noise, so we'll never be able to perfectly reconstruct quantum theory with this. Because we'll always have some noise, we'll never be able to find a GPT reconstruction that is self-dual. But we can get pretty close. So we wanted to do more preparations and measurements. So this is a table of data, which is mostly empty. We wanted to characterize 1,000 measurements, measurement effects, and 1,000 states. And so we know from our experiment I just talked about that the data looks like it's maybe rank 4. So in theory, we should be able to just perform 4 measurements on each of 1,000 states to reconstruct them, and send 4 states into each of 1,000 measurements to reconstruct them. And that's represented by this very thin, turns out we used 6 rows of data on the top and this thin 6 columns of data on the left. We chose to use 6 measurements and states instead of 4 just to allow our data to tell us if there were additional dimensions in the data. But it turns out that, you know, k equals 4 was still the best. And once we did our fit and characterized the GPT states and effects, we can predict the measurement outcomes if we had done all of these measurements and all these preparations. And we got something that looks like this. And now if we plot the state and effect spaces from this fitted table of data, we find something that looks similar, but the spaces are a lot smoother, and it's much closer to self-dual than we had before. If you zoom in, it's hard to see, but there is still a gap between the state and the dual spaces. And our volume ratio increased to about 97%. Okay, so I want to pause here before I talk about non-contextuality and just overview some of the what I think are the interesting features of this GPT tomography experiment. The first is that it's a self-consistent tomography method. So we characterized our states and measurements at the same time. Normally in quantum state tomography, what we do is we assume that we have some well-characterized set of measurements, and we use those to measure different density matrices, and vice versa for measurement tomography. But here we didn't assume anything about the states or the measurements. We just fit them all at the same time. So this is a self-consistent type of tomography. And we also inferred the dimension from the data. So we didn't assume that we were fitting to qubit density matrices. We just let our data tell us how many degrees of freedom it really had, which happened to be 4. And you know, by doing this, and by only assuming classical probability theory, we're able to kind of reconstruct these state and effect spaces, which agree very well with quantum mechanics. And in terms of this volume ratio, we're able to kind of upper bound how much any post-quantum theory of a single photon's polarization could deviate from the quantum prediction. OK, so now I'll talk about how we can use this GPT tomography to make inferences about non-contextuality or contextuality. The short answer is that we can use our reconstructed, just given the reconstructed spaces, we can calculate how much we violate different non-contextuality inequalities. But I'll explain what I mean by that for the rest of the talk. So as I mentioned in the introduction, I'm going to be considering testing preparation non-contextuality in the second sense. And just a brief overview, I know we've seen this a lot already this week, but the ontological models framework says that a preparation will probabilistically prepare a state into an ontic state lambda with some probability distribution. And our measurements have these response functions, which probabilistically return an outcome 0 or 1 given a specific lambda. And we can recover measurement outcome probabilities with this formula. OK. And we need to define these notions of operational equivalence. Two preparations, P and P prime, are operationally equivalent if, for all measurement outcomes, and for all measurements, you get the same, or they give you the same measurement outcome statistics. And actually, we don't need to consider all measurements. We only need to consider all measurements in a tomographically complete set of measurements. There's an equivalent notion for measurements. They're operationally equivalent if, for all preparations in a tomographically complete set of preparations, you recover the same measurement outcome statistics. And the assumption of non-contextuality is that operational equivalence implies equivalence in the ontological model. So specifically, operational equivalence for preparations corresponds to the same distribution over ontic states in the ontic model. And operational equivalence for measurements means that you should describe their response functions the same in the ontic model. OK. So the contextuality that non-contextuality inequality that I'm going to talk about is the parity oblivious multiplexing inequality, which we heard Jamie talk about on Wednesday, I believe. And he gave a very good introduction to this topic, so I can kind of fly through the next few slides, which is nice. But I'm just going to be considering the two-bit case. So the way that you can describe this game that Alice and Bob are playing, so Alice is randomly given some string x, two-bit string x, where these are all chosen uniformly. Bob is given an input y, and Bob's goal is to guess one of the bits of Alice's input string. If he gets y equals 0, he wants to guess the first bit. If he gets y equals 1, he wants to guess the second bit. And there's a cryptographic constraint that Bob is not allowed to learn anything about the parity of Alice's input. And the question is, how well can Alice and Bob do at this game? So we can define a success probability, which is just an average over all 8 combinations of x and y of Bob correctly guessing the y-th bit of Alice's input. Okay. So we saw on Wednesday that the best classical strategy that you could do gives you success probability of 3/4. And it turns out that what this classical strategy is Alice can just encode, say, the first bit of her input and send that to Bob. If she was to encode more than just one bit, then Bob would be able to learn something about the parity of Alice's input. So she can only send one bit. If Bob happens to get the right value of y, he just reads the bit that Alice sent him. If he gets the wrong bit of y, then he just has to guess. And the average success probability is 3/4. Okay, it turns out that this classical success probability is true for any non-contextual ontological model, specifically any preparation non-contextual ontological model. I don't think I have time to go through this in detail, but the point is that we still end up with this bound. So in quantum mechanics, we can violate this inequality. And this is one way that you can do it, and this happens to be the optimal quantum strategy for this two-bit case. So depending on on what input Alice gets, she prepares one of 4 states. So if this is a plane of the Bloch sphere, she might prepare, this could be her 0, 0 state, this could be her 1, 1 state, 0, 1, and 1, 0. And then Bob can just define, depending on which bit y he gets, he can measure, he can do a projective measurement in one of 2 directions. And parity obliviousness is conserved here, because the equal mixture of the Alice's 2 even parity preparations gives you the maximally mixed state. And the even mixture of Alice's 2 odd parity preparations also gives you the maximally mixed state. And the important thing is that this equal mixture is equal to this equal mixture. So there's an operational equivalence. And therefore, Bob cannot learn anything about the parity of Alice's input if Alice uses this encoding. But if Bob is interested in learning just the first bit of Alice's input, then he measures in this direction. And there's some asymmetry between the first bit being 0 and the first bit being 1. So he'll win with some probability. If he's interested in the second bit of Alice's input, he measures in this direction, because there's an asymmetry between the bit being 1 and the bit being 0. And it turns out that the optimal success probability you can do using quantum mechanics is cos squared pi over 8, which is about 85%. Okay, so we've reconstructed these GPT sets of states and effects. And the question is, how well can we do in violating this parity oblivious multiplexing inequality? And one way that we would answer that question is we just search over all possible GPT states and search over all possible GPT effects. And we try to find a set of 4 states and 2 measurements, 4 states for Alice and 2 measurements for Bob, and that do the best, give you the highest success probability. The parity obliviousness constraint implies that the equal mixture of the two even parity GPT states has to be equal to the equal mixture of the two odd parity GPT states. And okay, so to make this optimization a little bit easier on ourselves, what we're going to do is just approximate our state space with a sphere. Specifically, we'll find the largest sphere which fits completely inside the state space. We'll approximate the effect space with this dual cone sphere shape, and specifically the largest one which fits entirely inside the effect space. And we know that because we can take any convex mixture of states or measurements, we can achieve any preparation on the surface of the sphere or any measurement effect in this dual cone. And then we can just use our quantum intuition and find GPT states and effects, which are distributed in the same kind of way as in the quantum case. And given these, we can just take the dot, calculate the success probability with these states and effects. And we find we get about 83%. So it's a little bit lower than the quantum bound. Something nice here is we get the operational equivalence kind of for free. So we didn't actually have to go in the lab and prepare this exact state, like prepare each of these four states exactly. We've just verified that since they lie inside the space of GPT states, that we could prepare them if we wanted to. So we can find states which violate this inequality. And because we've approximated our state and effect spaces with spheres that lie inside them, this gives us a lower bound on how well our system could do at violating this equality. So it's a lower bound on the maximum success probability for this system. We can also consider calculating an upper bound. And the way we do that is instead of searching over all the GPT states and effects, we search over the dual effect space and the dual state space and use the same type of procedure. We just search for parity oblivious sets of states and effects, or sets of states and a state of effects, which maximize the inequality violation. And again, we use the same kind of trick where we approximate the state and effect spaces with spheres. But now we find the smallest sphere which lies outside the dual space. And similar thing for the effect spaces. And what we find is that our maximum success probability is slightly higher than the quantum prediction. Okay, and we can do the same thing with our more densely populated state and effect spaces. And these are the numbers that we get. So the lower bound on the maximal success probability is this number. The upper bound on the maximal success probability is this number. And these happen to be within about 1.2% of the quantum predictions. And I forgot to say this earlier, but all of the error bars that have been in the talk so far, those are inferred from doing Monte Carlo simulations on our raw data. Okay, so just to summarize, our GPT tomography scheme allowed us, with only assuming classical probability theory, to reconstruct a full state and effect spaces of a system. We've minimized the assumptions about the dimension of the system. So we let our data tell us what dimension of model we needed to represent that data. The reason I say minimize assumptions instead of completely remove assumptions is because it's possible that, you know, there is some measurement that we didn't perform in the lab that we could have done that would have revealed additional dimensionality in the data. And we performed a lot of measurements and prepared a lot of states and got some pretty good evidence about the dimensionality of our system, but I mean, I would maybe call this a tomographic completeness loophole in our test, and we're not sure how to entirely close that. And then this GPT tomography scheme allowed us to test this non-contextuality, preparation non-contextuality inequality. And I think finding the kind of these lower and upper bounds on the maximal violation gives us, you know, in a sense, how contextual our theory is. I put amount of contextuality in quotes because it's not well defined, like the contextuality fraction that we heard about on Monday, but It's kind of hand-wavy how much contextuality in our system sense. Okay, thank you. So we were interested in characterizing the polarization degree of freedom of a single photon. And quantum mechanics, which is pretty good theory, kind of tells us that those states will live along on a sphere. So we use our intuition from quantum mechanics to choose wave plate angles, which would give us quantum states, which are kind of evenly distributed among the sphere. But I want to stress that our data analysis didn't assume quantum mechanics at all, but our intuition for setting up the experiment did. And so the second part of your question is, how would we have done this if we were expecting a three-level system? Is that right? Well, so again, given our quantum intuition, I would have done a different experiment because I don't expect the experiment I did to have, right? I only expected to have two levels. But if it did, in fact, if we were in fact measuring a three-level system, our data would have shown that. And it, where we would have found that is when we were deciding the optimal rank to fit our to our data table. It would have been a number that was larger than four.
You could now imagine that you are in front of a three-level system something that in quantum theory is a swirl like a Q-crit, so you have a notion, you will pick again your initial handle states using quantum theory.
Because we're trying to gather evidence for the number of tomographically complete measurements, so we would use everything we know to try and make sure that we can reach those. Yeah.
I very much like your concept of GPT tomography, and I have just a little bit kind of a stupid question that have you compared your data analysis methods in a case where you just make some classical measurements? Because you have ways to, for instance, say how well your reconstructed state space is self-dual. I would like to know how close to self-duality you come when you just make a classical measurement and then use the same data analysis. Did you make that kind of comparison?
No, so we didn't do that.
Okay.
I don't think there's a reason to necessarily do that. Because if we wanted to do classical measurements on a qubit, so the classical state space for k is equal to 4 is just a triangle. And so we can, I don't know in what sense you mean to do a classical experiment,
well,
because I can just calculate these states
just,
and
just
the effects.
Not even do measurements on qubit, but just you test your data analysis. You get some data, you pretend that you don't know that it's just a classical measurement, and then you make your data analysis and see what kind of, you should
so
of course get that one.
Issue states from
yes,
here,
yeah.
And
then I assume that you get something very close to this triangle, but perhaps there is again some gap, but is the gap much smaller than in your actual experiment?
I see. Yeah, that's a really interesting thing to look at. I think
so I guess in this experiment, you didn't have 100% detection efficiency.
No.
So there's some post-selection on the data. And I'm very ignorant about the proofs here, but I know that in Bell inequality experiments, people worry about post-selection and fair sampling and things like this. I mean, it seems like this is an experiment where you could actually test for fair sampling. You could derive a fair sampling. You could just demonstrate you have fair sampling by expanding your analysis to also include the failed detections. So my question is, have you done that? And And is, and maybe this is a question to Rob, is fair sampling something I should worry about in these experiments? Maybe you can answer your bit first.
But I'm going to start by trying to answer the part for Rob.
That's okay.
And so I don't have the exact details, but Rob and Rai at one point told me that they worked out ways to close the, for specific contexts, Rai and Polly, they worked out a way to close the detection loophole. And the short answer is it's easier to do in contextual reality experiments than in locality experiments. Because you can't gain as much from this detection in these different experiments. And the first part of your question was, what if I considered the missed detection events?
Yes, could you just extend your analysis so that that counts as an extra measurement outcome? And then just incorporate it in your reconstruction. I mean, it's just an additional effect that corresponds to not detecting a click.
Yeah, so I think that I could do that. And what I would have found if I did that, is instead of reproducing a block sphere of radius 1, I would have reproduced a block sphere of radius close to the efficiency of my star. So it would have been...
What you want to show is there's no correlation between the probability of the click and the state you prepare or the measurement you make. Because that's the fair sampling assumption. Now, I don't know if you need to test the fair sampling assumption in experiments like this. Maybe you don't. But I would have thought that you could derive it using these methods. You could just prove that the detection efficiency is uncorrelated from the choice of setting.
I see.
Well, certainly you could give some very good confidence of fair sampling being true.
Okay, that's an interesting thing to look at.
Because I love the idea that you're doing full tomography on your qubit, and I almost want you to sort of extend your full tomography to the whole experiment and not post-select. And I don't know whether that's an interesting thing to do, but it seems like something that these methods could be extended to do. I mean, it's a general question as someone who's quite ignorant on these things. Is fair sampling something that people worry about in non-contextuality experiments?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What would be the difference between GPT tomography and tomography you might do just with like Bayesian data analysis or something like that? Or what's the difference between GPT and Bayesian probability?
I'm not very familiar with Bayesian tomography techniques, so I don't think I can give a good answer to that question. But can you explain what you mean by this?
Well, you seem to use a lot of probability, or I guess really my main question is, what do you think would be the difference between GPD and Bayesian probability? Or maybe they're the same, because you're using conditional probabilities and other probability analysis. I'm just trying to differentiate the two, or maybe there's not.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that. Maybe they're the same, but I don't know enough about probability to see precisely.
Just to comment on that, I mean, you're using like frequentist, well, classical statistical tests, but we're in a regime where there's a vast, vast amount of data for each, pretty large amounts of data, right? And so you expect that you won't get too much different from a Bayesian data analysis.
Yes.
First of all, the first point. The first thing you do is to check dimensionality. Previously, you reject an outcome if you don't have detection. So, in this particular analysis, I think the detection efficiency is important. In particular, it would be great having perfect detection.
So one additional comment here is that I don't think you can actually statistically rule out locality effects. I mean, non-detection effects in locality tests, because there are examples of models where you have a violation of Bell inequality through using reduced efficiency.
Yes.
And you cannot see that reduced efficiency as an effect on the outcomes, I mean the statistics. It's just something, a mechanism that's built into the model, and you don't see it in the statistics. So I don't think you can make a statistical test for that. That's why people tend to put a lot of effort into ensuring that you've got high detection efficiency in locality experiments.
But you could you not present evidence that the distribution corresponding to the detection efficiency and the distributions corresponding to the data factorize?
That's
the lambda that's important.
The lambda is important.
So I think it is, while it is true that the detection loophole is a valid loophole if you're testing Bell's notion of local causality, because the hidden variables can leverage that and, you know, be prepared to answer certain questions, and if they realize they're getting the wrong kind of question and they're going to be caught, they just give no detection. But according to my notion of non-contextuality, suppose you did the experiment, and as you say, you verify that the probability of no detection is independent of the preparation procedure. Preparation non-contextuality insists, therefore, that the probability of the no detection event must also be independent of the ontic state. Okay? And so now the ontic state does not have those strategies that it did in Bell experiments to leverage no detection events. And that is why no detection is not a loophole for these sorts of tests.
Thanks.
That's exactly why I don't like Rob's
Because it solves a problem.
Because it postulates there is no problem.
No, it takes Leibniz's principle, gives evidence that Leibniz is a great methodological principle.
This is the central point. It says, well, I like Bell inequality theorems to be nice and clean. They should say, for all hidden variable norms. In your case, it's for all hidden variable norms, except the ones that I don't include. Analysis. By
except
definition.
The ones that violate Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles, which has been formalized in a very concrete way, and all the logical conclusions of that principle have been worked out. There's nothing ad hoc about this approach.
I don't like it because it says the theorem applies unless there are hidden variables I didn't think of. And I don't like that kind of theorem.
So let me just clarify one point, which is that the fact that there is not a detection loophole in non-contextuality experiments, for my type of non-contextuality, was not an input to the program. I did not start by saying, oh, let's see if I can get around this. It was something that we realized was a consequence of this definition of non-contextuality through an argument which was not apparent for many years. Okay, so that makes it feel much less ad hoc than you're suggesting.
I don't agree.
At the risk of annoying Leibniz, I could be particularly perverse and challenge the convexity assumption you started with, and say that, well, when I flip a coin, there's some sort of signal that modifies how the preparation actually works, and so on, right? And maybe
well,
I
that's
could,
exactly how it works.
Right. But did you actually, in your experiment, did you use mixed states?
In my experiment, I tried to prepare pure states, but of course they were always slightly mixed. And as a consequence, all of those GPT states and also measurement effects that are constructed were slightly noisy and slightly noisy.
But I understand that within this GPT framework, if I understand this GPT framework correctly, then you use convexity in building up everything and so on, which is fine. But you could actually test that assumption experimentally.
Yeah, Well, let me go back to that slide. Because I disagree that it's even an assumption.
Ah, okay.
And I think Rob talked about this on Monday as well, and I'm going to give the same argument. Okay, so all I'm doing is I'm saying that I have two preparation procedures. This one's set to setting A, this one's set to setting B. When I hit a button on this one, it outputs a state. When I hit a button on this one, it outputs a state. Now I'm saying that I just flip a coin, and so probabilistically I choose whether I implement this procedure or this one, and then I output a state. And I'm just going to call that mixture a new preparation, but I'll just label it with a C. So if you, that's something that we can always do. I don't see how it's an assumption.
Of course, no. But suppose when I flip the coin, the signal went out and modified how gadget A or gadget B worked. Then the probabilities wouldn't necessarily add in that way. I'm not suggesting this as a real possibility. I'm just, you know, in the spirit of thinking about weird stuff. one could contemplate that. So one could say, I mean, I understand that this is the framework of these GPTs and that's so on. But let's say we want to be particularly perverse and go outside of that.
So let me take your criticism to a larger conclusion. So I think what you're saying is that I'm assuming that every time I hit this button, the same state is being prepared. And if that was the case, that is an assumption in a sense.
It's not just that, it's that it could be modified by that coin in a particularly perverse universe.
But, okay. So that's a specific way that it could change, but I'm making the assumption that it doesn't change anyway.
So Mike, can I go ahead and jump in?
So it is true that had we flipped a physical coin and made the choice of our preparation conditional on that coin flip, there would be a possibility that the particular functioning of the preparation, you know, became dependent on the fact that we did flip that coin. And maybe we could go and do it without the preceding coin flip and do it with the preceding coin flip and say, we see the operational statistics are different. That coin flip had an effect. If you say, well, what if the operational statistics are the same, but ontologically something happening is different, then you're violating preparation non-contextuality. So if we had done that experiment, we could have derived the independence of the ontological representation just as another application of preparation non-contextuality. But, so you might say, well, did you go and test that? And in fact, we didn't need to do any of that because we didn't flip any actual coins. When we define our mixture of a PA and a PB, we're just saying, look, we know exactly where PA and PB are as GPT states in the model. And now we infer what an equal mixture, for example, of those two would be as just the point between them in the model. So we can infer the statistics of our mixtures just from characterizing the individual extremal preparations. We do not need to set up an experiment that generates that mixture by virtue of a random sampling.
Right, but does the whole analysis here depend on the validity of that, the way the analysis of that mixture works? I don't know GPT well enough. I'm just asking a question.
Yes.
So, no.
okay, well then that's fine. Then it's in fact not an assumption.
That's right.
That's what you're telling me.
It's not an assumption.
So,
for this, for our previous experiment, that would have been a more interesting question. But for this experiment, that is not an assumption.